I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour made his first political fundraising call in June of 1992, and over the next 15 years was responsible for raising over $200 million for Democratic Party candidates. He says in his book, just released, the story of the explosion of money in American politics over the last 20 years can't be told through charts and graphs and laws and figures. It's best explained by someone who had a front row seat to it all. Who are these donors? What drives them? What can fundraisers get away with? And how did we, he asks, politicians, donors, and fundraisers screw up American politics so badly? That's what the book is all about. And the book, written by our guest this hour, Lindsay Mark Lewis, is Political Mercenaries, the inside story of how fundraisers allowed billionaires to take over politics. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Lindsay. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Lindsay has now found legitimate work as executive director of the Progressive Policy Institute. He was the finance director of the Democratic National Committee and has raised money for all kinds of people. House Minority Leader Dick Hebhart, John Dean, a number of senators and mayors and governors and you name it. Lindsay, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
Well, Kathleen, thank you for having me on.
Yeah. The first thing that I know, well, there's so many things to notice, but when you look at money and time, it's amazing to me the number of hours that people in Washington now spend on the phone in some way trying to get money for their reelection per week and what they used to spend per year. It's unbelievable.
It's shocking, and I think people have sort of accepted the slow growth of this, but you know, we're at a point now where it's absolutely ridiculous that, you know, if you're going to run for Congress, you better understand what you're getting yourself into. And what you are is, you know, having to spend 12 to 15 hours a week.
Whew.
Making phone calls or going to lunches or going to dinners, and it changes how you operate and actually changes who ends up running for Congress.
Well, I would think that there have to be, Lindsay, a number of members of Congress who really don't like this.
I would say it's almost 90%.
Is it?
You know, you have a few of the outliners that for some reason, and I won't go into the psychological reasons, who adore fundraising, but the rest of them don't. And they're in a catch-22 trap in that if they don't raise the money, they're not going to get reelected. Or worst-case scenario, they're actually going to be targeted to be defeated. And so they have to play the game, and they're forced to play the game also by the structure of Congress and how you have to appease your leadership on both sides of the aisle.
Mm-hmm. And you suggest, getting to the end of the book at the beginning, that there something to do with time might be very important in terms of limiting all of this, right?
In my opinion, and coming from doing this for 15 to 20 years, you know, I think it's the answer right now. And it's less about, you know, a quid pro quo, dollar for dollar, you know, I give you a check, you do something for me, which is what the reformers have been focused on for a while now. It's a process of what you do with your time when you're in Congress.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can actually limit the time that you can campaign, because we all have to remember, you know, campaigning is not governing. And we've transitioned in the last 20 years that there's no difference anymore, that governing is campaigning. And if we can find a way to take a few steps backward and say, get elected, go to Washington, and actually do something before you start raising money for your next reelection, which is 2 years away, you know, I have hope that something along those lines would actually help our democracy at least minimal.
Mm-hmm. And you were talking about 100 days of campaigning.
Why not? You know, 100 days before a primary, it's still going to allow the incumbents to get reelected, which is what these guys in Congress obviously want to do. It'll give an opportunity for some challengers actually to maybe be a little more competitive, but it would change how you operate during those 18 or 20 months between elections. You know, and maybe you you start hanging out with people in your district or people that you have something more in common with than wealthy donors that you end up spending your time with now. And 100 days is, you know, it's almost a European style.
Right.
It's a little more, I hope, keeping the American tradition, you know, it allows people to get around the free speech thing, because we're not saying that you can't raise money or that you have to limit the amount of money you raise. We're just saying, you know, you have to have a campaign period. And it will change the rhetoric in Washington, because now you have to appeal on a pretty consistent basis to the fringe elements where the money comes from.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it would change our lives so much, right? Just think of how many ads we wouldn't have to see.
Right. We just got through an election, and you're going to start seeing ads for some of these Senate candidates in January, February, and certainly the presidential by June.
I know. Isn't that wild? It's just wild. Tell me how you happened to. It's kind of a funny story. Not too funny for you, because you wound up spending a lot of years doing this. But were you an altruistic, idealistic young kid who really wanted to go into politics and thought this was a pure thing to do, to go into fundraising?
Unfortunately, I fell into it by mistake. You know, I grew up in a great middle class liberal family that, you know, it gave me the opportunities as a kid to be involved in some civic causes. And, you know, both of my parents had a history of civil rights volunteerism in the 60s and 70s. And, you know, I got a job in the Capitol, which was to me the greatest thing I could ever do. And one day I had to take an envelope from the Capitol over to another office, and that, unfortunately, was a campaign contribution. And those guys that I gave it to actually liked me and ended up staying there for the next 15 years.
And wasn't there something rather questionable about doing that?
For me, personally, I did not like money in politics. I just, you know, the year before, I'd spent the entire summer watching the Keating 5 hearings, in which five senators were, you know, called out on the ethics of helping Charles Keating. And to me, you know, somehow taking a check from the U.S. Capitol contribution was
right.
It didn't seem right to me.
Right.
Now it's a daily occurrence now.
So who are these? And tell me how it's gone from kind of a grassroots give $5 or $10 and host tea parties at your house or coffee parties to get behind your candidate to these few hundred rich liberal elites taking over the Democratic Party. We'll talk about who they are in a moment, but how do we go from what we used to have to these liberal elites?
It's the structure of our campaigns, unfortunately. In the late 80s, early 90s, you know, when I first started being heavily involved in this business, you could run for Congress from Kentucky or even Wisconsin and raise $200,000 or $250,000 and get reelected or elected for the first time. And that was money that you could actually gather from your state or your district with maybe a few other do-gooders that might have helped you from labor or like-minded other groups. Now, in order to run for Congress, you have to raise $1.5 to $2 million, which is approaching 10 times what you had to do 20 years ago.
Goodness.
And you just can't raise that in only so many districts can actually fund that.
Mm-hmm.
That would be your wealthy districts in San Francisco and New York and L.A. Outside of that, you have to go around the country and find that money, because you're not going to find $1.5 million in Milwaukee. It just doesn't exist for a Democratic candidate running for Congress.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to go out and find a way to appeal to folks that can fund that.
And so you have spent, in your job as a fundraiser, hobnobbing with the likes of Kevin Spacey, Ted Kennedy, but Billy Crystal, Bianca Jagger, George Soros, Ed Asner, Norman Lear. What were you doing? Just asking them directly for money or hoping that they would give, talking about causes with them? How did you rub shoulders with these folks?
This is the process that worries me a lot. it's not calling these folks and asking for a $1,000 contribution to a candidate. It's spending time with them and taking candidates to go see them on a regular basis, whether that's, you know, once a month or 3 or 4 times a year. And you spend time sitting down with them and talking politics and talking policy with the hope that not only are you going to get that $1,000 that you would have gotten had you made the phone call, but that these folks are going to get some of their friends to give,
right,
and they're going to continue to give to you for the next 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it changes, you know, if you're from Wisconsin, it's great that you're running for Congress and you're doing a great job. You also are spending more and more of your time on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, you know, going to breakfast, lunch, and dinner with folks that don't necessarily have the same view of the world that you would from the Midwest. And it's not a quid pro quo change of who you are. It's a subtle conversational change that you're spending so much time with people that don't necessarily understand your district or what your district is about.
And what's in it for these stars? Why does Billy Crystal need to give money? What's the reason for it?
You know, they some of them give money, some of them give their time to help raise money in other ways. You know, I think Kevin Spacey does a lot of fundraisers, or at least attends a lot of fundraisers for candidates. You know, they have personal views of the world, and they certainly want to see those views put out there and represented. And this is the, you know, having a member of Congress or either a House member or a senator come visit you or spend time with you, that's the greatest access you could ever ask for.
Hmm. And who was the one, I'm trying to remember, who had all the dogs? You had some event you had planned, and this actor, I think, had to bring all his dogs. Who was that?
That actually was Kevin Spacey.
It was Kevin Spacey.
He was coming to D.C.,
okay,
and he had to fly with his dogs, and we had to scramble to find a hotel with a large enough suite that would accept 3 large dogs. And you know,
well, I'm with Kevin Spacey on that one.
All right,
if you're going to do all this, do it with the dogs, right?
Exactly.
Man. What a world. We're going to welcome phone calls for our guest. We're talking about what's happened in terms of fundraising, and our guest was on the inside of this for a long, long time, from 1992 to 2007. He was the finance director of the Democratic National Committee during the time of Howard Dean. He is now the executive director of the Progressive Policy Institute. So he tells some pretty remarkable stories of what it's like getting money and has some acute observations of what's happened in terms of time and money. If you're running for Congress or if you're running for president, how inordinately large amounts of money are going into some of these campaigns, why that's the case, and what people expect from it, and what we should do about it. His idea, what do you think of this, that we limit, which would limit money as well, if you limit campaigning to 100 days. Is that the answer? We need something more? Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is @KDunnShow. And Mark is now executive director of the Progressive Policy Institute. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this time period, it has been years since we've done classic comedy, and so we thought we cover so many serious topics that we just need to laugh. And so tomorrow, an hour devoted to laughter with some classic routines. You'll be hearing from Bob and Ray, two of our favorites. Bob Newhart, somebody suggested the Abe Lincoln, Madison Avenue. What if they got a hold of Abe Lincoln? How would they tell him to campaign? Mel Brooks and Carl Reiner, Lily Tomlin, and many other comedians during our 2 o'clock show tomorrow. So tune in and be prepared to laugh. And if we have room maybe for some small routines, leave your suggestions on our Facebook page, and we might be able to get to a few of those tomorrow at 2 o'clock. All right, let's go to phone calls. Our guest this hour is Lindsay Mark Lewis. He is the author of Political Mercenaries, the inside story of how fundraisers allowed billionaires to take over America. No, to take over politics. Jeff in Madison. Hi.
Hi. I'm just curious. It occurred to me. We've all heard this is the least productive Congress in U.S. history, the least legislating. And I always presume this was because of political fighting or foot dragging or whatever. Is it possible it's just due simply to the fact that they aren't there? They're just all out raising money, neglecting what even their own constituents sent them to do? Thanks. I'll listen.
All right. Thanks, Jeff.
Yeah, it's somewhat of that. It's also, when you think about money in politics right now, the numbers are so big that, $2 million for an average House candidate, the benefit of passing legislation is not there. Because you want to yield as much money as you can. So if you pass a bill in the first month, you've got 17 more months that you need to raise money. But, you've just taken away that opportunity. Why not stall as long as you can to raise as much as you possibly can?
Yeah.
I mean, it changes how Congress works. And this has happened in the last 20 years.
And talk a little bit about how the campaigns, again, the money figures for campaigns, what it cost to run for president in 92, what it cost for the Obama campaign in 2012, what it cost to run for Congress. You've mentioned this, but let's hear those numbers again.
Yeah, I mean, I think on average in 1992, if you ran for the U.S. House, you spent between, $250,000 and $300,000. This last year, last month, it was the average winning candidate was over $1.5 million. It's a dramatic increase in 20 years. I think Bill Clinton ended up raising a total of about $100 million in 1992.
Mm-hmm.
And, next year, over the next 2 years for this presidential, we're looking at close to $10 billion.
That's awful.
But, just think of the process that goes into that and it's absolutely crazy that we think that this is acceptable at this point.
Well, you were finance director of the Democratic National Committee when Howard Dean was to shake things up. What did he want to do, and did he accomplish what he wanted to do?
I think Chairman Dean did a great job on trying to include all 50 states in the as far as funding from the Democratic Party. The thing I tried to do as finance director, which I failed miserably at, was to try to make grassroots donors have more power than the wealthy donors.
Mm-hmm.
And my unfortunate experience through that was learning that didn't help change politics, because now you were having to appeal to masses of people with almost heated rhetoric that was not good for our political system. I actually thought grassroots donors would be the holy grail that would save us. And I was wrong.
Let's go to Chris in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. I heard it suggested, I'm sorry, I don't know who by, that every potential voter get a $50 voucher to give to the candidate or candidates of their choice. To me, that's not only more fair, but it also gives everybody more of a stake in the elections. What do you think?
Who gives us the voucher?
It would be a government thing. It would be a government payout instead of elections being funded by personal individuals. Elections would be funded by the government, but we'd all get a piece of it. So I get a $50 voucher, and so would you, and then we could put it to the candidate of our choice. Or candidates, split it up.
Lindsay?
It's a little impractical. Impractical. It wouldn't work. And, first of all, I don't think we're ever going to see public financing of federal elections. I think we're a 50-50 country right now between Republicans and Democrats, and there's no chance that many Republicans would ever go for that. I'm not sure how that would solve it and how you'd end up paying for that. That's what are we at, 300 million people in the country right now? I can't do the quick math, but 50 times that is still a lot of money in politics.
Doesn't it strike you, it wasn't all that long ago that we were having long discussions and thought there was a wee bit of a possibility that everybody would embrace public financing of elections? You don't even hear about it very much anymore.
You don't, and that's why I think it's unrealistic at this point. If you wanted to do a constitutional amendment to get two-thirds of Congress and two-thirds of states to approve this, you know, I don't think we'll see it in our lifetime.
Yeah.
So I think we have to look at other ways to try to solve the problem.
Thanks, Chris. John, Green Bay. Hi.
Hi. I don't think you're ever going to get money out of politics, but I always thought that something on the order of probably take a constitutional amendment to the effect that you can't donate to the campaign of a person you can't vote for.
It's unique. Again, we're running into a constitutional amendment problem, which is unrealistic. But, you know, if you're a congressman that represents Milwaukee, does that mean somebody in Madison can't contribute to you, even though you represent the same state? It becomes a free speech issue on who you're supporting.
John, you want to respond?
No, there's never simple solutions to anything, but I always thought, like, recently we had a congressman in southern Wisconsin elected, and more than half of his money came from out of the state of Wisconsin. And I always thought that person's job is to represent me, not somebody from Texas or California.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my issue. That's one of the reasons I wrote this book, is we have allowed, not just allowed, we forced that congressman to have to go raise that money because there's not enough locally. We've put too much money into politics. But on a free speech constitutional level, you know, if somebody credible runs against Ted Cruz in 2 years, you know, I wouldn't mind giving that person $50, but maybe not.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, you look at people like Sheldon Adelson on the Republican side, and you have those who are interested in running for president next go around or the next go around have to go and have these conferences with him. He's entertaining visitors who are going to run for president. And you know, you look at it, you have to look at it and say, well, wait a second, he's just got one vote. I've just got one vote, but he's got billions and I don't have very much. And there it is. There's the whole thing, right?
Exactly. And that's the problem. And you're not going to see him to get a $1,000 check.
No, I'm sure you're not, right.
You know, but you're going to spend all your time with him.
I know.
And it changes how you think. And it's not a quid pro quo. He's not telling you to do X for X, although Sheldon maybe. But it's how you spend all your time with somebody and some people like that. It skewers how you think about politics and who you actually end up representing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I tell the story that 25 years ago, how we described members of Congress was, you know, something like Senator Hal Heflin was an Alabama Democrat, or Silvio Conte was a Massachusetts Republican. That's not what we say anymore. That's a Tea Party Republican, or that's a liberal Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
It's a nationalizing of our politics.
Let's go. Thanks, John, for your call. Ralph in Little Suamico. Hi.
Yes. Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I think that what's going to happen, and it is happening already, is that basically the people that they may have a desire to do the right thing, but then that pressure for the money makes them basically do the wrong thing. When I look at the budget this year and find that they attach something about reforming the rules on Wall Street, so loosen everything up, that was pretty much both Democrats and Republicans. I give Nancy Pelosi a big applause for speaking up, but when that vote comes down, you're going to see people on both sides, and when it happens, they're going to say, well, we were against that part of it, but we just had to do this because we didn't want to shut down the government.
Mm-hmm.
So there's always an excuse on every one of these things, and it's all influenced by money.
Lindsay.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's the process around money that bothers me. You know, this was an awful bill that passed last week, but at the same time, there were some good parts to it. But that's how Washington works. And going back to what I said a few minutes ago, having the ability to delay as much of this legislative action to the last minute is extremely beneficial to members of Congress. You're able to raise money all the way up to the end. And that's why there's no motivation to get anything done early next year, and you won't see anything really done, because why take away the ability to raise money when you need to raise $2 million? Stretch it out, you know, make our democracy almost foolish, but it will benefit you personally.
I wanted to talk to you a little more, because the book is partially about this as well. This idea of trying to raise, I mean, in the last midterm elections, we were seeing as much as, you know, $1, $2 million a day coming in to various coffers in the last week before the election. And I was thinking, well, the ads were already bought for the most part. You couldn't find space on TV mostly. Where is all that money going? Last minute money.
Yeah, it's a good question. That money flowed in a lot in 25 years ago, and there were still TV ads you could buy. And most members of Congress actually raised two-thirds of their money in the last 6 weeks. Now you raise two-thirds of your money before then. But, you know, that last-minute money goes to direct mail, goes to unfortunately, some of these robocalls that are not the most pleasant thing to get.
Mm-hmm.
And then also it rolls over into the next election. And you know, it gives a head start to incumbents going forward.
Thanks, Ralph, very much for your call. Greg in Watertown, hi. Greg? He's not there. I'm sorry. Please call back. Brad in Clover, hi. Clover. Hi, Brad. Hello, Brad.
Oh, hi, I'm sorry. Yeah, I called in to mention that I'm part of a group called Wolf-Pack.com Wisconsin chapter, and we're fighting for our legislators to pass a resolution that would call for an Article 5 constitutional convention, and that would introduce a 28th amendment to the United States Constitution, trying to get money out of politics, public financing of campaigns, and then reversing Citizens United. And we think it's more feasible than petitioning Congress to do it, because we think that our congressmen are just too bought with the big money, whereas we're hoping our state legislators will be less so. I wondered if the guests knew about that, the Article 5 convention route to getting money out.
I am familiar with some of these efforts to get the constitutional amendment. You know, I go back to being practical about this. I mean, I think the problem is really bad, and we need to find a way to solve it now. Getting two-thirds of our states, which are, you know, almost 40 states now, are actually controlled by Republicans at the state house level. It is a noble effort. It's not going to be effective, and it's not going to happen in the next 30 to 40 years. I'd rather let's find something that we can do today that makes Congress at least work for some of us, in a better way. And get back to finding a way for Congress to represent the middle class and to represent their states. Having a constitutional amendment is a great idea, and it's a great cause. You know, getting Texas to vote for that's not going to happen. Getting probably Florida to vote for that's not going to happen. You just go down a list, and I can't find 35 states that are going to do this.
Mm. And this idea of limiting campaigns to 100 days, how would that have to be accomplished, Lindsay?
You know, I think it's pretty simple. And there's different ways you could do it. You know, in fact, the Democrats could do it themselves today. If you can't even have a bank account as a candidate and you can't open that until 100 days out, that means you can't accept contributions from anybody, whether that's $5 or $10,000. And if you could limit that to 100 days, everybody's on the same playing field. You as an incumbent, you're actually probably going to spend a lot more time at home in your district and less time traveling around the country raising money, because you want to get reelected, and the only way it's going to happen with less money is to spend time in your district with your voters, and the concerns that they have are going to be more forward in your brain than the concerns of some donors around the country.
Mm-hmm. We have an email. One caller wanted to know, what's the difference between a bribe and a campaign donation?
It's that would be easy if we could prove that it works that way. In the end, it doesn't. It's not. It'd be simple to say that somebody gives you a $5,000 contribution, and you do something for them. It doesn't work that way. It works as far as you spend time with those people, and you hear about their concerns, and you think about how to motivate them to give to you again in 2 years or a year from now. And that's how the bribe works. It's not a quid pro quo. I'm going to give you money and you're going to, vote for this bill because it's important to me. That would be too easy and easy to prove. It doesn't exist. That's fortunately and unfortunately not how Washington works.
Brad, thanks for your call. Sherry in Whitewater. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Sherry.
I think we could fix this if we made Election Day a national holiday so that everybody could vote. Because if we don't get our voter turnout higher than it's been, 33% in Wisconsin in the last election, which is just disgusting. People are killing each other in other countries for the right and privilege to vote.
Oh, it was higher. It was higher in Wisconsin.
Voter apathy is just rampant because of everything that's happening in Washington. And until people stop letting it defeat them and start making their voices heard, nothing can change.
Yeah, it was higher than that in Wisconsin, Sherry, because of the gubernatorial race. It was, 57 or 59 in Wisconsin? Not that that is particularly high, but it is true. The figures that Sherry was quoting, national turnout was in the 30s. It was very low.
It was, I think, in the end, 36%, which I think tied for the lowest since, I believe, 1932. But we have to ask, first of all, we do have to focus on making voting more accessible, and that's a separate issue that the Democrats really should be pushing. But, there's a reason people don't vote. They are turned off by this process. They don't think Washington, people that we send to Washington, represent them. We have to get back to having those members of Congress that come from those communities that you want to connect with, and we don't have that anymore. And money is the main reason we don't have that.
Yeah. More phone calls momentarily. Our guest this hour spent 15 years raising money, in this case for the Democrats. He worked with all kinds of people running for office, mayors and governors and presidential candidates and members of Congress. He is now executive director of the Progressive Policy Institute, was the finance director of the Democratic National Committee. His book is Political Mercenaries, the Inside Story of How Fundraisers Allowed Billionaires to Take Over Politics. Lindsay Mark Lewis is our guest. And here's how you reach our conversation. We have lines open for you right now. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and Twitter @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this time period, we're going to do classic comedy. We like to take a break from serious subjects every 2 years, it seems like. We haven't done one of these shows in 2 years. We used to do them four times a year, but we just got a lot of other things to talk about. So tomorrow we will return to classic comedy. We'll hear from Mel Brooks and Carl Reiner with The 2,000-Year-Old Man. We will hear Bob and Ray. I love those guys. Several of their skits. We will hear Lily Tomlin. We will hear Bob Newhart and other classic comedians tomorrow from 2 until 3. So tune in and laugh. Arlene is our next caller in New Berlin. Hi, Arlene.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I'd like to say that during George Washington's time, there were no politicians in Washington. They all had real jobs, and they came to Washington when there was something to vote on, and they didn't get paid like they get paid today. There should be no career politicians, whether House of Representatives or Senators. They should all have real jobs away from Washington and come together when it's time to vote. and there should be a limit as to who can donate what kind of money, so we don't have the problem we have today. And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right, Arlene, thanks for the call. Lindsay?
Arlene, that's true that Washington was a very different place in 250 years ago. But, you know, we have a very complicated federal government, and there are a lot of problems, not only at home but around the world. And, you know, it is a full-time job, and I'm glad that we have a lot of great people up there. You know, the system doesn't work and the process doesn't work, but in order to deal with all the problems we face, not only as a country but around the world, you need a full-time government, and you need a full-time legislator that can take the issue that he or she cares about and spend some time, which is not going to happen in 6 months or a year. It takes years to become experts on some of these issues, and I'm glad that we have some of those people in our government. And so I don't think the answer is a part-time Congress is not going to solve the problem. The process of how you run for Congress and what you do when you're in Congress is something we need to change.
Jerry, Minnesota. Hello.
Hello?
Go ahead, Jerry.
Hi there.
Okay, Jerry, go ahead, please.
Yes. I'm from Minnesota. I'm driving right now to Wisconsin. And I'd like to say that we are putting the wagon to pull the horse. The people have got to do the voting, not policies, but not the elite, not the rich.
Yeah, you're cutting out there.
I didn't catch what he was trying to say.
They were putting the money before the people. Let's just say that's what he was going to say, because we can go somewhere with that. I'm not sure that's what he was going to say, but
And it is true. And this goes back to my time argument. You know, it's not a quid pro quo relationship, but when you spend all of your time on the phone or meeting, if you're from Wisconsin and you're spending a lot of time in New York or San Francisco or L.A., you are putting money before your voters.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the trip you took. I can't remember who this was for, but it was a little bit of a harrowing trip to Puerto Rico because you thought there might be some money in Puerto Rico and the air flights that you took. Who was that for?
That was for Dick Gephardt, who was the minority leader of the Democratic leader of the House back then.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and first of all, there is a lot of money in Puerto Rico for both Democrats and Republicans. It's well worth the trip. Besides the beach down there, I think an average member of Congress can go down there between the some of the pharmaceutical companies that are down there because they're not regulated like they are here or taxed like they are here. And,
mm-hmm.
and same with the liquor. It's $100,000 trip, which is fruitful. So I think the more you move up into leadership, or the longer you stay in Congress, it's you get to know Puerto Rico well.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, as a youthful indiscretion, I did do some stupid things on that one trip to Puerto Rico and ended up with now a legal substance in places like Colorado, but back then an illegal substance.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. And youthful indiscretion is the only way I can excuse it. But I got away with it and didn't have to spend 10 years in a Puerto Rican jail.
Mm. Lucy sends this email. If the Supreme Court makes a decision for corporate free speech, how would your ideas work to limit 100 days? It wouldn't pass the Supreme Court free speech test, would it?
You know, I disagree, and that's why I'm getting at the time limit. This is not taking away your free speech. You can still participate in the election, and that's why I'm trying to be practical about available solutions. If the Supreme Court wants to say that money is free speech and unlimited money is okay, which I disagree with them on, if you limit the time, it's still free speech because you have a campaign season at that point, and you can say what you want during that season instead of having to do it constantly and over a 2-year period if you're a House member or a six-year period as a senator. I don't think, you know, I'm not a constitutional lawyer, but free speech in 100 days is acceptable.
Let's go to Eric in Sun Prairie. Hi, Eric.
Hello, how are you guys doing?
All right, Eric. Our phone line is a little iffy here, but yep. Carry on.
All right. I just had the thought, wouldn't instituting term limits have a similar effect as curbing money in politics? And do you think that executive order might be a way to get that done? I mean, President Obama's got 2 years left in term, put an executive order in limiting the amount of time that Congress can be reelected.
I think term limits is a terrible idea for Congress and would only exacerbate the current problems we have. You know, if we need to get Congress back to representing their states and their districts. And if you're going to limit the time they can serve, whether that's 4 or 6 years, once you get elected, you're going to be looking for your next job. And it's unlikely that it's going to come back, you know, you're going to go back home to your district. They don't do it now. So you're going to represent folks that can help you after that 4-year period or 6-year period, however you want to do the term limits. And you're going to make the situation, you know, virtually 10 times worse than it is today. And, you know, we're going to end up representing only the wealthy people that can afford to essentially hire these members of Congress after they've done their term limit. You know, the voters are, you know, I don't think the voters in America are stupid. We have to change the process where they're given an opportunity that an average person can run for Congress and let the voters decide. Mm-hmm. We don't need term limits to do that.
Lindsay Mark Lewis, our guest, and his book is Political Mercenaries, The Inside Story of How Fundraisers Allowed Billionaires to Take Over Politics. Lindsay was a fundraiser and made it all the way to being finance director of the Democratic National Committee. He raised money for Democrats from 1992 to 2007, and the book is filled with all kinds of stories of hobnobbing with billionaires and many familiar political figures, and it's a thriller in a way. It reads as a thriller. I was thinking a little bit about Elizabeth Warren this week. Or a number, did I give it to you? 800-486-8655. I've been thinking about Elizabeth Warren, who really has been prominent for a long time, but in the last couple of weeks particularly prominent. And maybe she'll run for president, but maybe she won't. But I'm thinking, have we reached a point now, Lindsay, where it would preclude someone from, like Elizabeth Warren, from being able to run? Because where in the world is she going to get money?
You know, I think if she ran, she'd have plenty of money.
Really?
And, you know, I think this comes from, you know, the grassroots action and the freedom that some of the new tools have allowed us, you know, the internet and the emails. You know, she'd be able to compete competitively with if she decided to run. I have no inside knowledge that she's going to run. But the problem is, in order to be competitive like Elizabeth Warren, who I actually think is doing a decent job in the Senate, you have to be like her, and you have to be on almost virtually a no-compromise plank. Because that's the only way she could ever raise money, is to never, you know, cross the aisle and work with the other side. And that's where our politics has gotten. Whereas, you know, 20 years ago, she could still be that person, but she could do it during the campaign and actually legislate and govern when she wasn't doing that. And that's what I worry. But the money's out there for her if she's out of the run. I have no clue if she will. Just like I think there's a lot of money from the grassroots for Hillary Clinton. You know, we're going to have a $10 billion presidential election, and Democrats are going to raise half of that. It's going to be a $5 billion Democratic Party.
Hmm. Well, except that Hillary Clinton is more likely to get the Wall Street money, isn't she?
Well, at this point, I think any Wall Street person that gave Elizabeth Warren money would probably lose their job. But, you know, Hillary's not just about that. I think it's unfortunately a simplistic attack on her. You know, she has the ability to raise a lot of money. I think presidential elections are a lot cleaner than other elections.
Really?
Because there's so much more money. And when the ability to say no to a donor exists at that level, because you have so much money, It does not exist at the lower level, which is, you know, it's not much lower, but Senate or Congress or a member of the House, it's much harder to say no to a donor when you're talking about a $2 million campaign because you need that money. When you're talking about, you know, I would figure if Senator Clinton, Secretary Clinton decides to run, she's probably going to raise $500 million directly into her campaign. She can say no to somebody when you're talking that much money.
Let's go to Robert in Eau Claire. Hi, Robert.
Hi, how are you, Kathleen?
Good, how are you?
I'm good.
Good.
Say, why don't we just require our Congress and our Senate to accomplish something once a month?
To accomplish what, Robert?
some legislation, some viable legislation.
So we could name a post office once a month?
Well, you know, something more than what they've done. They haven't done anything. They're elected officials, and they haven't accomplished anything except go on break.
It is pretty remarkable how little has been done, Lindsay. Isn't it?
It is remarkable, and this is, I keep going back to it, this is a function of money in politics. And it's not a quid pro quo function. It's, you know, what is the motivation to accomplish something early on? For a new Congress, you don't have the ability to raise money, you know. And you know, there's a whole system in Washington of people that make a lot of money off of the current situation. That's from, you know, some of these K Street folks. You know, as soon as you pass a bill, they stop getting paid because you don't need them anymore. And members of Congress, people stop going to your fundraisers if you've already passed their bill. So. The motivation is not there, and we've got to change the process where you don't even think about that going forward.
Thanks, Robert. Let's go to Bob in Madison. Hi.
Hi. I guess your 100-day idea is good, but I still think that these folks would still be meeting with people the entire term, and then in the last 100 days they'd take the money in. So I can't see it would make a big difference, that's all.
There's some honesty to that, but it does change because that's fine. Some of these guys will do that, and maybe they'll raise a bunch of money, you know, as soon as that clock starts on 100 days. But it changes how they're going to operate in Congress. You're not going to spend all your time doing that for 18 months. You know, as I said to somebody else, that, you know, if we actually pass this, these guys will be walking around the Capitol for the first couple months because they wouldn't know what to do. You know, now they know what to do, which is to go make phone calls or go visit with a donor over lunch or dinner. That changes now. If you can't get something from that person, you know, you're not even going to think about it for another year.
And thanks for the call. We have about a minute left. You've been in these meetings. I'm just wondering how they go. Let's say that you're going to Bianca Jagger and you want her to give $500,000 to Hillary Clinton or whoever it's going to be. What do you do? Do you sit down and ask for the money right off the bat, or how do you do it?
You know, there are some people that do that, and they're not very effective. Unfortunately, what happens now on both sides of the aisle, and I want to make sure that everybody understands, this is not a Republican issue. It is a bipartisan issue.
Uh-huh.
The most effective way to get this done is you walk into a room and you attack the other side. And you say how evil those other guys are.
Hmm.
And if I don't get this money, they're going to do X, Y, and Z.
Right.
And it corrodes our political system. And it forces you to be angry and partisan when you shouldn't have to be always. I have enough issues with the Republican Party, but, you know, I have the same issues with the Democratic Party. And we've got to figure out, we've got to change the dialogue and the process.
Mm. Lindsay, thanks very much. Thanks for being with us.
Kathleen, thank you so much for having me on.
Lindsay Mark Lewis. The book is Political Mercenaries, the inside story of how fundraisers allowed billionaires to take over politics. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing the hour and to KP as well for on-air production in our downtown Milwaukee studios. We'll be with you tomorrow. I want to remind you that our book list that Daniel Golden, we had so much fun with him yesterday at this time, he's put together the list. It is on our Facebook page. I know you like those lists. Don't worry, it's there. It's the Kathleen Dunn Show. Also, if you have a comedy sketch that you would love to hear tomorrow afternoon during our classic comedy show from 2 to 3, we'll go right to the same place and write down your suggestion, and we'll give it thought and try to put it into the show. Thank you for listening. And there are great conversations ahead, and we will be with you again tomorrow at 1 o'clock.